Well, let me extend to you my thanks for your warm and kind greeting to me and for the conversations that we've had. I've been very encouraged and very much appreciate all that you have said. I thank you for your prayers for our work in Escondido. I thank you for allowing your pastor to participate in our work in Escondido. I'm sure you all know that he has been appointed a trustee of our institute. Hope to have him with us, I almost said next month, but it'll be in early December. Tomorrow it will be next month. And really thankful to God that he was willing to join with us and enter into that great responsibility of training young men for the gospel ministry. I would have liked to have had an opportunity to give you a report on the work that we're doing. It just didn't fit into the opportunities that we had this week. We have about 14 students, five first-year students who seem to be very keen. Two of my sons are students in preparing for the gospel ministry. We're very encouraged with all the work that's going on and thankful for what the Lord is doing and are hopeful that in the years to come we'll see more and more men who are prepared to go out and serve the Lord Jesus Christ in churches. And speaking of churches, I want to talk for a little bit tonight about some of the churches from the 17th century. Now, you know, when we talk about history, we usually talk about people and events. Those are the two things that usually get our attention. But as Christians, we ought to be interested in churches as well, because the Bible is not a book that's simply about individuals. It's about individuals who are gathered together into churches. All of the epistles, except maybe for a couple of personal ones, were written to churches. In fact, almost everything that Paul wrote was written to churches. Even the letters written to Timothy were to help him and Titus. Timothy and Titus were to help them in their responsibilities of leading churches. You have Philemon written to an individual, perhaps one or two others in the New Testament, but most of the New Testament is about churches. So what I'd like to do for the next few moments at least is to talk about some of the churches that first adopted our Confession of Faith. Now this morning I use the analogy of portraits. I want to use a slightly different analogy tonight and talk about snapshots. Now, you know what a snapshot is. It's just a single photograph of a moment in time. And we all have them. Probably all of us have them up on top of the piano or a shelf in the living room or on top of your dresser in your bedroom. And your snapshots remind you of special individuals or favorite places that you've been. I don't want to take the time to paint a portrait of these churches. I want to speak of snapshots. So there are different things to emphasize about different churches. When I was doing my work about 15 years ago, I had the privilege of spending a long time in England doing the research. And what I was working with primarily were the church books that were left behind by these churches. Someone in the congregation, oftentimes one of the elders of the church, would keep a leather-bound book. Sometimes they were very big. Sometimes they were very small. And in these books were the records of the church. Sometimes they had narrative stories. Sometimes they had financial charts. Sometimes they were the records of the congregational business meetings that were held in each of the churches. They were really fascinating to work with. And these things that I'm going to tell you now are little tidbits that have come out of those church books. I want to give you an idea of what church life was like, what our sister churches, had we been alive then, they would have been our sister churches. What were they like? And what would it have been like to live in them? Well, I think that I have 10 churches here that I want to talk about, and I have a couple of different stories about them. Let's begin with the Devonshire Square Church. Now, we talked this morning about William Kiffin and his ministry there, his long ministry among them. This church began around 1645. The first church book that still exists begin begins in the 1660s, and it has the largest amount of information for the 1670s, 80s, and 90s. In the 1690s, the Devonshire Square Church in London was composed of 216 members. Now, what's interesting about the fact that it had 216 members is that 60 of them were men and 156 were women. Almost 3 to 1 is the ratio of women to men in the church. I was able to tell by looking at the charts or the front of this church book, everyone who joined had to sign. I was able to look at that and figure out that there were about 30 married couples in the congregation, and there were 2 elders in it. Now, probably the Devonshire Square Church was an average-sized particular Baptist church. 216 members, 30 couples, 2 elders. That's a snapshot of Devonshire Square. Not too far away in London is the second church, and one of the most important, and that's the Petit France Church. That's the one I talked about this morning, where Nehemiah Cox and William Collins were ordained on the same day. Now, this is a very detailed church book. It has lots and lots of information in it. It has a different system of recording the members, and I tallied up some of these things. It's very interesting. From the period of July 31st, 1676, to the period of January 20th, 1688. So that's a period of about 12 years. I was able to identify 538 members in that congregation. Now, I don't mean by that 538 were added to the congregation, but over the course of those 12 years, there were 538 who were listed. 193 were men, 345 were women, 67 married couples, 2 pastors, and 12 deacons in the congregation. Now, they also kept record of things like baptisms and transfer of membership both in and out. And during not quite as long the period of time, from 1675 to 1684, I was able to identify that they had 108 new members by baptism. Now, that's a pretty decent amount for 9 years. Wouldn't it be great if any of our churches had 100 baptisms in 9 years? I think sometimes if we have 9 baptisms in 100 years, we're happy. But they had 108 baptisms in 9 years. They also had 98 members who transferred in their membership. Now, this was probably the largest of the churches, and it was centrally located in London. And, of course, you have to think of the economy of England in the 17th century. I liken it to a place like the Philippines in the 21st century. I had the opportunity of going to the Philippines several years ago. And the Philippines is a place where families with the ancient family farm, the families have grown so large that there isn't any more room for the sons who grow up in the family to farm that plot anymore. It's been divided and divided and divided, and now the plots are very small out in the countryside. So most of the children of the family make their way to the big city, which is Manila, and Manila is overrun with people and with poverty. And I imagine that that's something like what London was to England 350 years ago. So it's not unusual that they would have so many members coming in by transfer, just about exactly 100, because people would have moved from the countryside to London in order to seek employment. We also learn by looking at that church book that there were 23 people who transferred their membership out, which means that they had about a 75% net gain in terms of transfers. 100 come in, 23 go out, do the math, you end up with about 75%. And interestingly, 1680 was the year in which they had the highest number of baptisms. And in 1680, they had 17 people who were baptized. That's an average just about of 1.5 every month. That's a pretty good record as well, to have that number of people who are baptized. Let me move on to the third church to give you a snapshot. The first two were in London. The third one is out in the countryside in Devonshire. Now, if you can think it all about a map of England, if you've ever seen one. This is down in the south and towards the west, a good distance away from the city of London. And there in a town called Bampton, in 1690, a church was formed. It had 39 charter members when that church was formed. Now, I know that we have been involved in an aggressive church planting program for a long time, but I can't remember any of the churches that we as Reformed Baptists have planted today that began with that large of a nucleus of people. That's really a good start, isn't it? 39 members in the church. There were 18 men and 21 women, so it was almost 50-50 in that congregation. They started up with three elders and three deacons out of their men. Fourth church to mention, back to London, was a church in a place called Maze Pond, M-A-Z-E, Maze Pond. Now, this is an interesting church. It has a checkered history. It was founded in February 9th, 1694, by six men and 13 women. And it was the result of a church split. Now, this is one of the places where you had the kind of church split that we have seen in our own lifetime, where people walk away angrily from a church and begin something new. They actually left Benjamin Keach's church. Remember we talked about Keach this morning and we said that his church was the predecessor of Spurgeon's Metropolitan Tabernacle. Well, in 1694, that church had a split and it was over whether or not it was proper to sing hymns in public worship. It was a very large church, Keach's church, and it was really only a handful of people who left. But they began this church on February the 9th, 1694. There were 19 people who started the church. Now, over the course of the next 18 months, that's not really a very long period of time, is it? 18 months. But over the course of the next 18 months, until August of 1695, they added 107 members by profession of faith and baptism. Now, that's an oddity, isn't it? Because usually churches that begin from a church split don't do very well. In fact, a lot of times, they don't even survive. But in this case, this church increased five times over by adding more than 100 new members into their midst. This was addition by profession of faith and baptism. And it was interesting that I found baptisms recorded in every month except December during that 18-month period of time, which means that they were baptizing people in November and in January and in February and in March, the coldest months of the year there in London. Only December did not see additions. Of the 107, there were 29 men and 78 women. Now, there is a characteristic about the Maze Pond Church that is familiar to us, and that is the next month, after this 18-month period, so this is September of 1695, this church, which had grown so amazingly, so quickly, all of a sudden found itself in trouble, and the trouble came from the same members who had left Keach's church and were now unhappy in the church that they themselves had begun. They were causing a great deal of difficulty, and at that point, it was necessary for the church to seek after help. For the next 7 years after this problem, they added 54 members upon profession of faith, 18 men and 36 women, so exactly twice the number of women than men. But it took them 7 years to add half the number of people that they had added in 18 months before, all of it because of the problem. Now, you know, and I know, that oftentimes church splits happen because somebody with an angry temper or someone with a proud spirit presses forward his own ideas, forces them upon the congregation. Most of the congregation is unwilling to pursue whatever that issue is, and this individual goes off and takes some people with him. Well, what's at the root of that is a sin problem. Oftentimes, it's masked by a practical or theological issue, but at the root of it, it's a sin problem. And it's not surprising that that sin problem manifests itself sometimes later. Here, only 18 months later, we find that this church is again enduring trouble. Now, fifth snapshot. I'm going to take you all the way up to the north to a town called Bridlington, which is on the coast of Yorkshire. This is a long way north of London. In September of 1698, there was a nucleus of individuals there who wanted to form a particular Baptist church. And so they did, forming it with 22 members. They had 9 men and 13 women, 1 pastor, 1 elder, and 1 deacon. 2 officers in the church, 22 members beginning this congregation. It may still be in existence, I don't know, but it had a long and notable history. It grew as a result. Sixth snapshot, something different. We've been talking mostly here about members and about church growth. Let's talk about a different issue. A town called Burton-on-the-Water. Now, that's out in the Cotswolds, which is to the west and a little bit north of London. It's one of the most picturesque parts of the Kingdom of England. If you've ever seen pictures of houses with thatch roofs and that look really quaint up in some beautiful hills or villages, that's probably from this area. When we were in England a couple of years ago, we went over to Burton-on-the-Water to visit it because there in that town, in the Baptist church there, there had been a pastor named Benjamin Bedome who served for about 50 years. And he served very well and the church grew wonderfully under him and we wanted to go see his grave. We were able to find his grave out in the cemetery. You know, when you go to London and you go to St. Paul's Cathedral or Westminster Abbey, you see graves, monuments that are huge, they're beautiful, they're built up to honor the famous who have died. When you go to Burton-on-the-Water to see the grave of Benjamin Bedome, you have to find it out in a graveyard, and it's just a little stone that says his name and his dates, and that's all that it is. And unless you know who it is that's lying under the ground there in the cemetery of Burton-on-the-Water, it just looks like the grave of another individual from somewhere in the past. Well, before Benjamin Bedome was pastor in Burton-on-the-Water, in 1701, the church decided that it was time to build a new building. In fact, it was their first church building. For the most part, churches were not able to buy and own property in the 17th century. So they took up they made a plan and they took up the procedure to build a church building, and they did it by taking subscriptions. Now, what basically that is a pledge to donate money to help in the erection of a building on a piece of property. The subscriptions that came in from the members of the church was slightly over 90 pounds of money. Now remember what we said this morning, 40 pounds would be a livable wage for a minister during this period of time. It would be on the low end, but it would be a livable wage. And so this congregation was able to pledge, in addition to their commitments to support their pastor, about 2 times and a little bit more than you might have expected a minister to be paid during that day, a cost of 90, or the subscription and commitment to 90 pounds. Now, how much did the church building actually cost to build? That's an interesting question. Now, what you might guess might not be correct, because to build the church building actually cost them less than the amount of money that the people had committed to. They committed to just over 90 pounds, and the actual cost to erect the building and move in was 87 pounds and a little bit more. So they profited. They made 3 pounds. I don't know what they did with those 3 pounds. Hopefully they gave them to the pastor or something. But it's very interesting that they were able at that time to raise that kind of money, that the people in the congregation were committed to have a church building, and that they were able to build it without incurring any debt on the property there in Burton-on-the-Water. And that would have been the building that about 40 years later, Benjamin Bedome would have come and served as the pastor. Very notable, notable ministry in a notable place, out of the way. If you go to Burton-on-the-Water today, you go there as a tourist. because it's an incredibly beautiful town. There's a little river that runs right through the heart of town, and everything is incredibly quaint. It's every postcard that you've ever seen about England, that's what Burton-on-the-Water looks like. And yet we went there because of the church and because of Benjamin Bedell. Let me take you a little bit north of Burton-on-the-Water to a city, or no, it's a town that's called Bromsgrove. Now, I'll tell you three things about this church in Bromsgrove. I want to give you an idea of the membership of this church over the course of a 25-year period. We've talked already about churches growing, or we've seen a snapshot of churches in a particular period, a brief period. Here's a 25-year period. What was this church like? In 1670, the particular Baptist church in Bromsgrove had 97 members, just about 100. 41 of them were men and 56 of them were women. Not quite half, 40% men, almost 60% women. 20 years later, 1690, they had 83 members. They had lost 14. They didn't grow. They didn't quite maintain. They went backwards a little bit. And they had 38 men and 45 women. So they were 3 men less, 9 women less in their membership over the course of 20 years. Not forward movement, backward slippage. But 4 years later, 1694, their membership book tells us that they had 98 members. So for some reason, over the course of 20 years, they lost 14. But in the next 4, they went back to 98, 43 men and 55 women. Effectively, what that says is 25 years later, they were virtually the same size that they had been 25 years before. The 8th snapshot that I want to give you is from a church in a place called Broughton in Wiltshire. Now, how many of you have ever seen a picture of Stonehenge? Right? Right? Yeah, that was, when I was a kid, I saw a TV show about Stonehenge, and all my life I wanted to go visit Stonehenge. And in 2005, my wife and my son Sam and my daughter and I went on a Saturday and we got to visit Stonehenge and I enjoyed it. But it's not so much Stonehenge that I want to talk to you about. It's about a church that met right in the area of Stonehenge. Right there on the plain in Salisbury, there was this church. Now it was a very interesting congregation. It had about 85 members. But the church was scattered among 4 or 5 villages in this greater area. And what they did was they chose an elder who was responsible for each of the different congregations in the 5 villages. And what they did was about 3 of the Sundays a month, they would meet in their own villages as individual congregations. And then once a month, they would come together for a large combined meeting of these 5 congregations. Now, they treated it as one church, with 5 elders and 2 deacons, even though they met at a distance from each other. Now, I've never taken a map and plotted it out and tried to figure out what are the distances between them, but I assume that they did this because it was difficult to travel any long distance on a Lord's Day. You might, if you were a farmer, own a horse, but one horse can't take a family to church. And your horse, probably you want to reserve it for use on the farm, so it's most likely that you and your family have to walk to wherever you want to go to church. So they decided that the best thing for them to do was to have smaller local meetings and then make a plan to come together once every month. There are interesting stories about that. That's where they observed the Lord's Supper when they came together. They took up an offering every month at that meeting, and the offering was to rent a horse for the pastor and buy him beer. That's what the record says. Very interesting little fact about that congregation in Broughton, Wiltshire. All right. Snapshot number 9. Let's go back to London and talk about Hansard Knowles Church in a place that was called Cripplegate. In 1695, now this church had existed also from the 1640s. In 1695, it had 132 members. 42 of them were men, 90 of them were women. Knowles had just recently passed away, and so its pastor was a man named Robert Steed. And interestingly, and somewhat unusually, Steed had a man who was designated as an assistant. His name was Richard Claridge, and Claridge was his assistant in the ministry. Now, I'm not exactly sure what to make of that, because I don't know for certain that Claridge was actually an elder, but he was designated as an assistant to Robert Steed in his work. Well, the last of the snapshots that I want to give to you is an interesting story from a city called Plymouth. Plymouth is down on the south coast of England, and yes, Plymouth in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, or actually it was the Plymouth Colony, was named after this Plymouth in Old England. It's a very interesting story of what happened in this church. In 1668, the church had flourished under the ministry of a man whose name was Abraham Chair. Chair had been well-loved and well-appreciated by his congregation, but he was arrested because he would not submit to the Church of England, and he was put in jail, never released, and he died in jail. I've been able to find copies of some of the books that he wrote, and they are very warm-hearted in their love for the Lord Jesus Christ. And you can understand why it is that people had such a high appreciation for this man, Abraham Chair. He died, though, in prison, and for 19 years, the church went without a pastor to replace him. Can you imagine a congregation going for 19 years without a pastor? But that was the circumstance from 1668 to 1687 for the Plymouth Church under Abraham Chair. Now listen to what happened next. In 1687, the church finally was able to call a man to come. His name was Robert Brown. And he came and he took up his ministry in Plymouth, and within a few months he died. They were again without a resident pastor. So the next year, they found a man named Roger Holdenby, who came from Ireland. And Holdenby almost immediately was unhappy living in southern England, and he asked the church to release him from his obligation to serve them as pastor. And the church did so and released him. Now think about this. For 19 years, they're without a pastor. The next pastor comes, Robert Brown, he dies. The next pastor comes, Roger Holdenby, and he doesn't want to stay after he's there, and he goes, and so the church is again without a pastor. Now the year is 1690. They've decreased, as you might expect, to about half the size that they were before. They had been over 100, now they have 52 members. 10 are men. 42 of their members are women. And they recognize that they need to do something to call for themselves a pastor. Now, there was a man in their congregation whose name was Samuel Buddle. And Samuel had been approved. He was basically the equivalent of what we call licensed to preach. He'd been recognized by the congregation as a man who was gifted and able to preach. And so in the process of seeking and searching for a new pastor, the sisters of the church, now this is 80% of the membership of the church, they could not vote in the congregational meeting. In their polity, only the men voted in a church meeting. But the sisters of the congregation got together and they wrote a letter to the brothers of the congregation. This is 42 women writing a letter to the 10 men and urging the 10 men in the most tender terms to make Samuel Buddle their next pastor. And he's one of the 10. It's really a beautiful letter. I wish that I had it written out so I could read some of it to you. It's very tender in its expressions of love to the brothers and appreciation for them, but it's also urgent and insistent, suggesting that here in our midst is a man who can take up the pastoral ministry And you almost get the feeling that they're saying to the guys, what are you thinking? Why can't you see that one of you can take up this ministry? Well, the men received the letter, and they received it positively. They deliberated among themselves, and the end result was that they did indeed call Samuel Buttle to come and to be their pastor. And he actually appears as pastor of the church in the records of the General Assembly that was held in London in 1690 in that year. Well, that's 10 snapshots from 10 churches. You know what I take away from these snapshots is this. Their churches were just like our churches. They were just like ours. And I get great comfort out of that. I really do. Some of them grew wonderfully. Some of our churches have grown wonderfully. They've seen the Lord's blessings upon them. Some of them stayed the same. They stayed at basically the same level. They plateaued. Some of our churches have plateaued. Some of them declined for various reasons. Some of our churches have declined. One of our churches in Southern California has just closed its doors up on the north side of LA. They struggled for years and years. They weren't able to make any headway. And they came to the conclusion that the best thing for them to do is to close their doors. When I look at this and I read about these things, I see the generosity of the people in Burton-on-the-Water who give more than enough money to build their building. Or I read about the struggles that took place in the Maze Pond Church after they had split off from Keach's congregation and they have the same problems erupting from the same people in their own midst. It tells me that when those things happen among us, it's not a surprise, is it? It's what has been happening in the Church of Christ for years and years and years. Well, let me say a few more things and talk about some important features of the churches. I have three things to say, and then if there's a couple of minutes left, we'll entertain some questions and we'll be done. I won't get to some of the material I wanted to do about the confessions of faith, but you've read some of my material and you've studied the confession, and that stuff perhaps is a little bit more easily accessible to all of us. Let me highlight what I consider to be three important features of the 17th century churches, of our brothers and sisters who preceded us by 300 years or so. First off, as I worked with their church books, I came to realize that membership was taken very seriously. Before a person could become a member of one of their churches, inquiries would be made into their character. Now, what that means is that if I moved to Fargo and I wanted to join your church and you took the policy or the procedure that they followed, you'd do something like this. You might write to the people, the church that I came from, and ask them for a letter explaining my character. Or if I were moving from one church to another in your location, you might send someone to my boss and ask the boss the question, does this man live like a Christian? Does he act as a Christian should when he's on the job? Is he a man of his word? Is he a man who works hard? Does he make money for you in what he does? You might send a messenger to the place where I live and ask the question, does he pay his rent on time? You might ask questions like that, because they wanted to be certain that the individuals who came into membership were individuals whose lives truly adorned the gospel that they professed. Likewise, they took discipline very seriously. Now, we have to be careful in the way that we express this, because I don't want you ever to think that discipline is something that was going on all of the time in these churches. In fact, when you read the church records, it's actually refreshing to see how few people had to be subject to church discipline. All right? So please hear me saying that. But they were concerned about church discipline. And you'll find all kinds of cases of church discipline, many of them for the things that you might expect. Someone who's guilty of immorality or someone who's guilty of lying. But they also practiced church discipline for men who were lazy, who did not take seriously their responsibility to support their families. They at times enacted discipline upon people who are guilty of being busybodies and gossips, who pried into other people's businesses, or business and talked about them behind their back. It was actually very interesting to see how carefully and concerned they were for Christian behavior in relationships with one and another. When they wrote letters from churches to churches, they were detailed and taken seriously. If you wanted to take the Lord's Supper at a church in which you were not a member, generally you had to present a letter of character from a sister church to demonstrate that you could be admitted to the Lord's Supper in that congregation. And it was very refreshing for me to find that they didn't only treat churches of their own type with great respect, they showed a lot of respect for churches that were different from them. Every once in a while in the church books, a general Baptist church will appear, and they treat that church with courtesy and respect. Every once in a while, a church that practices infant baptism, usually an independent or congregational church, will appear, and they always treated those churches with respect. It was refreshing to me sometimes to find that when a church was really in a bind, when they wondered what to do, on occasion, they would ask for advice from others outside of their circle. And in one or two cases, they would send letters to men like John Owen, explain the problem to him, and ask him for his advice in resolving the problem. I was refreshed by that fact, that they didn't just have to look at themselves. And so, they had a generous, outward-looking Catholic spirit, in that sense, among others. The second important feature, first one, membership taken seriously. Secondly, church office was taken seriously. What I found in these congregations, even in the largest one, is that generally they had few officers. They were slow to put men forward into office in the church. Typically, they would have something that they called a trial for office. That is, a period of time in which they would say, Brother Jones is being considered for the office of deacon, and for the next 6 months, we want you all to observe him and see if you notice in him the characteristics that are necessary for a man to serve as a deacon. Likewise, if a man was being considered for the eldership, they would have a period like that for him. Well, there's a lot more that I could say, but time is running out. The third characteristic or feature of the churches that I think is very important to notice is that inter-church relationships were taken very seriously. From the beginning, from the first appearance of the particular Baptists, they developed a doctrine of associationalism. And in the First London Confession, there is a paragraph that addresses the fact that churches need to join together. And one of the great contributions that they have made to Baptist life over the years is this practice of forming associations, sometimes local. For example, in London, there was an association of pastors who could fairly easily come together because of the compressed nature of the city. More frequently, there were county associations, and they would meet in taverns. They would go to a tavern that was central to most of the churches, and they would take a whole day to meet in that tavern. They didn't have church buildings. They would come together and do their business. They would answer theological questions, come to conclusions, and give advice back to the churches. Likewise, they were very concerned with the strengthening and building up of other churches beyond their own. It was not unusual to find in the church books that they took up offerings for pastors or churches who were in need. Let's say that during the period of persecution, they found out about a man who was put in jail and his family was destitute, and they would take up an offering that they would find a way to get to his family to take care of them. If one of the men had a barn burned down or a house burned down, they would find a way either to go and to put a new building up for him or to provide funds by which he might be able to do that for himself. Likewise, in the 1690s, they came to the conclusion that they needed to do something to encourage pastors of churches which were not able to support them at a livable wage. And they began something that continues to this very day. In fact, I met a man a few years ago who was the beneficiary of this. It was called the Particular Baptist Fund. And it was a common fund that was begun in which they asked churches and they asked wealthy Christians to donate money to this fund. And there were nine men who were appointed as trustees, and these men were appointed to invest the money and to distribute the money to supplement the income of pastors from small churches unable to support them. That fund still exists today. And I met a man a couple of years ago who was pastoring a very small church up in Scotland, and part of his stipend monthly was a gift that came from the ongoing work of the particular Baptist fund nearly, well, over 300 years later. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. Likewise, they recognize the importance of providing some option for ministerial training moved ahead with that. Well, there's a lot more that could be said. Time is running out, and I realize that there's another meeting to get to this evening. So I think I'll stop right there. If any of you would like to ask any final questions or make any final comments, be glad to entertain them right now. Otherwise, I'll turn this over to whichever elder will conclude the meeting for us. So anyone like to ask anything else? Yes.
A lot of the statistics you mentioned in regards to gender, obviously many more women than men. I'm just curious if that aligns with the overall demographics of England or if there's a reason that you're aware of?
Yeah, you know, I always get asked that question, and I don't really have a good answer. The demographics did favor women over men. I don't remember what the ratio was, but it wasn't anywhere near this kind of ratio. But the best answer that I can give you is that in the history of the church, it seems that has been the tendency anyways, is that more often than not, we have more women in our churches than men. In some of them, the ratio was almost 50-50. In others, it's 80-20. For example, the Plymouth Church in 1690. So I apologize that I don't have a better answer than that. But it's a fair question.
I'm sure the other congregations outside of particular.
As far as I know, it would have been generally true, yes. Yes, sir.
And can you speak to church architecture? As you've studied these churches and have visited many of them firsthand, do you notice any commonalities among the churches?
Well, that's an interesting question, church architecture. For the Baptists, there weren't any churches really until probably 1680. A couple of years ago, I was in the oldest surviving Baptist meeting house. It's in Tewkesbury, which is out in the west of England. And it's just a very small, beautiful, little, very plain wooden room near the abbey, a big cathedral in Tewkesbury, but hidden away from sight, really. It has a little baptistry in the floor, and I had the opportunity to go down into the baptistry, which was kind of a treat. It's got to be one of the oldest baptistries in England. But it would be a very plain building, some windows, plain glass windows, wood beams in the ceiling. Probably, if you packed the place full, you might get 80 or 100 people in there. It was a little bit like this in that there was a gallery that you could walk in upstairs, and there were tiny little rooms on each end of it. But that's the only one of the ancient Baptist church buildings that I've ever been in. It's the only one that survived, so far as I know. In terms of the Puritans, so long as they were able to do so, they met in the Church of England buildings. In fact, for a period during Cromwell's rule, there was actually a Puritan congregation that met at Westminster Abbey, which is Westminster Abbey doesn't want to talk about that, but its pastor was a man named William Strong, and there was Puritanism being preached from the pulpit of this incredibly beautiful Roman-looking church building. So I don't know if I'm answering your question at all usefully. There are more Puritan-era church buildings accessible in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, than you would see in Old England at this point. And they're very plain. Yes?
Was Puritans, was that a denomination like Baptist? Or was it?
No. largely the Puritans were a group within the Church of England who were pressing for further reformation. And at first the name Puritan was a slur against them, but it changed forms and became something that many of them were willing to own, but that took about 100 years for that to happen. Finally, in 1662, when they were unable to submit to Charles II and his requirements to continue ministry in the church, they were all forced out. And from 1662 on, there really is no more separatism, and there's no more Puritanism. It's all joined together, and they call it then, nonconformity, meaning they can't conform to the Church of England any longer. So there was no denomination that was called Puritanism. It's more a movement describing men who want to see further reformation. All right, well, brothers, thank you very much.